Hey guys, it's Brandon from the MacroOps Value Hive podcast. At MacroOps, our aim is simple. We want to make high risk-adjusted returns consistently, continuously learn while doing so, and have a lot of fun along the way. And in this regard, our record speaks for itself. This is partly why we have by far the highest retention rates of any investing service in the industry. Collective members tend to stay members for a long time because there really is nothing else like us. We offer differentiated research, theory, and education resources, plus a killer Slack community filled with some of the smartest operators from around the world. Our members are predominantly professionals, but we also have a high number of highly motivated retail investors and traders. The one thing we all share is a deep love for the game of investing and an unquenchable thirst to get better. If this sounds like you, then consider signing up and checking us out. You simply go to macro-ops.com/collective. That's macro-ops/collective. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. Eric at YWR. This is another anonymous podcast that I found. Just this topic of inflation is obviously something that I've discussed a bunch in my writing and tweeting, and we're positioned for it in our portfolio. We're long inflationary assets. We think inflation's higher for longer. We've been saying that for a while. And our mutual friend Cuppy shared, I believe, he shared one of your pieces, and that kind of kickstarted my rabbit hole down, you know, your writing and kind of your thoughts on this. And I said to myself, like, no better person to get on the podcast about inflation than, you know, you, Eric. And so I'm super excited to have this conversation. We're going to discuss a bunch of different topics, from just basically phase transitions, pushbacks, deflation. We're going to go all the way back to the Roman Empire. It's going to be really fun. And so to get kind of the baseline on who you are, Eric, and how you got into this, walk us through kind of your background and professional experience.
Yeah, thanks, Brandon. And why would anyone want to listen to me, my views on inflation? My education background is undergraduate degree in economics and then a master's in economics and financial markets. So very familiar with the, you know, the academic thinking behind inflation. My professional career, I was a senior analyst and portfolio manager at a few hedge funds and a mutual fund, running a financial services book. So running investments in banks, insurance companies, real estate globally. So very familiar with how the investing in the financial players in these markets. And the last 7 years running, and I think this is the interesting, so I also say, I think on the point too, is it's very interesting to actually be in the market, right? To hear the academic side, but actually be running money and seeing real life how things work. But then also kind of, I think the unique piece is the last 7 years I was running a fund investing in equities and fixed income in Africa. And that's where you're investing in markets where I was dealing with markets and countries where inflation was 20 to 30%. Or higher. And that was very different for me. And that's shaped a lot of kind of ideas and new thoughts about inflation that I didn't have before. And so maybe I think those three things come together is why my perspective sometimes a little different than interesting maybe to hear.
And you invested in Africa, you spent 7 years there. What types of investments did you make? And how did you, like, we all think of like hurdle rates and cost of capital in the US as something very simple. It's like, oh, it's 7% plus the risk premium, la, la, la. But in Africa, I'm sure it's completely different and there are completely different risks, but maybe I'm wrong on that.
Yeah, we were a lot of just in terms of investments, the sectors are relatively limited, right? It's banks, telecoms, cement, beer companies. And then we would invest in local currency debt as well as euro dollar debt. So yeah, and sometimes we'd switch between the two. Sometimes you'd get interest rates of 25% on 1-year treasuries like in Egypt. And that was way more interesting than owning anything else. So there's periods where it was just really these dripping roasts in the treasury market. Sometimes the interest rates would be suppressed by the central bank and they weren't trying to fight inflation. And maybe the interest rates would be 10 and meanwhile inflation there's 20 or 30, then you're 100% in the equities. And those are just, you know, really galloping away. So that was most of the time you were in the equities.
And so when you're looking at these companies from an underwriting perspective, how do you assess like the cost of capital? Like, is it the inflation rate? Is it your internal returns? Because if inflation's 30%, even if you're making 20% returns, you're still trailing inflation in a way. So how do you think about that?
This is funny, or not funny, but actually I've never really heard this conversation in an African market before. When the inflation is 30%, they are really trying to think, how do they protect themselves? And they're scrambling to buy as much stock as they can. If the interest rates are high enough, they're in treasuries, but otherwise in these markets where inflation is really getting away from them, they're in equities and there's usually capital controls and they can't get out. So this is just, everything is just, what do you do to protect yourself? If you can get money into dollars, great. But usually you can't. And so you're buying equities and then sometimes into treasury. So yeah, it doesn't get very complicated other than that.
And before we hit record, you mentioned that the inflation narrative is almost this boy who cried wolf scenario where everyone since the GFC has said, oh, we've inflated, eventually it's going to pop. And it hasn't so far. I mean, you can argue that there's cracks. You can argue that we've kicked the can down the road, but everything's relatively okay, in air quotes. And you don't want to look like the, you know, as you say, the doomer gold bug, where they talk about inflation and they just kind of get cast into this bucket of, oh, this guy's a doomer gold bug. And even when I've been on Twitter and like been bullish on gold, I'm now like this gold bug, which is just kind of funny. So,
right. Yeah.
What is the difference, if there is one, between all those past calls and maybe what you're seeing now?
Yeah, that's, I think something that we should, I think there is a difference now, but I also, I just want to go back to that first part you said about the boy that cried wolf. And I'm very careful about, I think we should be careful about making an inflationary call and be read, you know, recognizing we have been getting this so wrong. It's a very difficult thing to, if I even go back even further to the 1980s and the deflation we've had, it's been 40 years of deflation that economists did not expect. So they were getting it wrong all the way down for the last 40 years. And surprisingly then we had a very interesting period after the GFC where you kind of got in this weird situation where central bankers were actually trying to create inflation, which was the poll previous had been, how do you fight inflation and how central banks need to be independent and what are the tools to get inflation down? So then we flipped to this period where you had central bank, especially Japan, going extreme, doing all these extreme things to get inflation to rise. And I thought, and I remember myself in 2014 being, surely this has got to create inflation, right? Like, when have you ever had a thing where central bankers are then trying to do it? And how could you have a situation where central bankers are actually trying to create inflation and it doesn't happen?
Yeah.
So it tells you they themselves didn't know how it worked. And so we've had this surprising period of 40 years of deflation that we still don't really know what happened. And there's a really great paper by Paul Rogoff. And what he's saying is, look, appreciate the fact this deflation happened across the world. It happened in Developed markets, emerging markets. It happened with countries with high debt to GDP, right? Japan had like 200% debt to GDP. It didn't matter. Inflation still happened. Kyle Bass was shorting the, you know, Japanese bonds and everything. So it really messed up with everybody's factors of what they thought caused inflation and their understanding of it. And so Rogoff kind of sums up, he kind of goes like, look at all these, it didn't matter whether you had fixed exchange rates or flexible exchange rate. He knocks down all the things that why, and it, he really comes back at the end, and he doesn't spend much time in the paper going into this because it's actually a very difficult topic, is he goes, I think that it was policy driven, that at the end of the day, sustained changes in inflation are driven by politics. And so now going back to, you know, and so just to appreciate that we've been getting it all wrong, and everyone's been getting it wrong, the Fed, the economists, the gold bugs, all of us, right? So let's just acknowledge this is a very tricky topic. But then going back to the last 4 years, if you look at just the, you know, if you were just a chartist and you were looking at CPI or number of countries with high inflation, something has changed. The trend just massively changed. We've had a very high spike in inflation that we had never had a rate up to 10%, and it stays there way above the Fed's target for a prolonged period of time. Number of countries with inflation problems across the world has jumped up. So technically, if you're just a chartist, something, there's been a change in trend. And the question is, and this is the, is what we've all been fighting, is are we going back? Are those deflationary trends, those mega trends of 40 years, are they still in place? And we're going back to 2%, which is kind of what the Fed feels. That's what Jeff Gundlach was saying. Or have we had a switch and something's different?
Yeah.
And I'm going to argue that I think something is different, but I'm also going to, sorry, I'm going on too much, but it's all right. I mean, but
no, you're fine. Like this is,
don't interject with me.
This is why I want you on the podcast. So you can just stream of consciousness.
Okay. So I sometimes push back against myself, right? So what's different? I would say, let's put a book, a COVID kind of, it kind of kicks off with COVID. And I think this is going to be one of these things like 9/11 or the GFC or one of these type of events that we think really changed into a new era. And so we go, why are we getting inflation now? Well, we had the higher debt to GDP, we have deficits, we have kind of this breakdown in trade and globalization. And you can come up with a few of them and we can go into them more. But the point I wanted to make is, as I push back against my own argument, I would say, yeah, but okay, Eric, but debt to GDP was rising before 2020, right? Breakdown with China, Trump was getting into tariff wars with China in 2017. Green energy and energy costs, that was already kind of happening. So I'm sorry, why do you say now it's different? Because in 2018, 2019, you could have said all those things and you still had less than 2% inflation. And this is where you mentioned that my phase transition kind of concept. And this is just my own theory. And because I go, look, all these things were happening, these trends were happening, but something has happened post 2020 where the economy is acting much more inflationary and it's not coming down, and we're having persistent inflation that is, everything is registering above expectations. And I think it's like water to ice or liquid to steam. If you're cooling water, you know, 35, you know, sorry, let's use Celsius, whatever, you know, 5 degrees, 4 degrees, 3 degrees, you're at it, you're cooling the water, nothing's changed, right? You can swim in it, whatever. One more degree down and it freezes and all of a sudden totally crystallizes, and now it acts completely differently. You can skate on it, whatever, right? In physics, it's a very incremental change in the energy in the system, and yet it acts totally differently. Same way on the way up, right? You're heating the water, all of it, you know, it's 100 degrees Celsius, it flips to a gas, and all of a sudden it's you know, it's floating off into the air. Algae, sometimes in equilibrium systems, like in a pond where there's algae, you know, there a certain temperature of the water, how much water is coming into the pond or out, the algae is under control. But if some, the amount of water in the pond drops a little bit, or there's a little bit warmer, all of a sudden you get an algae bloom. Sometimes you see these in Minnesota where the whole lake, like in a few days, like what happened? It just boom, the system got out. And I think that's what's happened. I think we have kind of hit some new phase where we're in, the economy is acting differently now. It is much more inflationary. And I don't know why. I mean, there's no physical physics book as to why what happened in 2020. And you could push back and go, Eric, why does us sitting in our houses for 6 months, why did that do it? I don't know. But I can just, you can see it in the numbers. The economy is acting very differently. Another, so I think it's very interesting. Like Jeff Gundlach, right? He had this view, right? And I totally could see the logic of it. And I thought it was very compelling. We had the COVID, we had the supply disruptions, companies were worried about whether they could get goods. And so they overstocked. Warehouse space was at a premium. People were trying to load goods up. So you had record high inventories relative to sales. You had high house prices. You had all this demand, you know, fiscal stability. People were airdropping money into our bank accounts. We're all buying everything. And that all falls away, right? So Gundlach's view was, we could have the same way you had 10% inflation. As this all falls away, why don't we actually go, it could go negative, right? We could have used car prices fall down, all this stuff unwinds rapidly as the stimulus falls away. Boom, we could actually get a negative GDP print. And actually the Fed's going to be, his view was the Fed was going to be wrong to the downside, that actually inflation was going to be drop much more quickly than they thought. And they'd be cutting rates much more faster than the dot plot. And actually, I think, interesting to note that that's not what happened. It made sense. And so I think the counterfactual, the fact that it didn't happen, and actually we've sitting here with, you know, almost 4% inflation still, despite that setup, that tells me, whoa, this is not acting like that. Housing market's fine. Wage growth is still 5%. And I think the logical answer to all that was that what was different was you had this very high fiscal stimulus, which we didn't expect, which was kind of a little bit different this time.
There's so much to unpack from that. And I appreciate you breaking all that down. And I think my job on this podcast is to ask questions that to some may seem obvious, may seem simple, but to me, I'm just curious. Take kind of that 30,000 foot view and really ask these, what I think are fundamental questions. The first one is like, why is inflation like detrimental, or like, what are what's the worst case scenario that happens from here? And then what are the drivers of that inflation that could kick this thing into not overdrive, but 4%, 5% and leave the Fed kind of in the dust where they're saying they're trying to get the 2% target, but that's just kind of a pipe dream.
Yeah. So I guess the first one is, why is inflation bad? Right. I think they've looked back on history and seen that it's been really problematic when you have a complete loss of value of money. And, you know, going back to Weimar Germany and France in the 1780s, and that generally a stable economy has the value of you generally a bit of value. They want a bit of inflation because it actually encourages you to borrow. It's actually not good. They don't like the other way, right? Where they want you to borrow, and they want the thing you buy to go up in value, so it's easier to pay back the money. So they would like a little bit of inflation, but they don't want high inflation. Why is it 2%? There's no real number. Why? I don't know. I mean, that has been an interesting question, why it's 2%, but it's basically a low number they would like. Mm-hmm. As to create stable growth. And there was also a view that high inflation could create unemployment. That's not it's not really that's that has there's so many exceptions to this that anyways, so the Fed would like low inflation. Now, I think your question is other questions. So how does this get away from us, right? How does it I want to say one point that this is again with the doomer situation that I don't see happening.
Yeah.
This is when I often talk about Zimbabwe just as an exaggeration, because it's interesting, you learn how markets act in the inflation. That's interesting. Or you talk about Venezuela or Argentina, but those, that type of inflation, which is happens a lot in emerging markets, where often it's where the country has borrowed in dollars or something. And so you have it's a small country. There's a collapse in the currency. People just want to get out of the currency completely. And it really implodes quickly. We're not going to have that in the US, right? So the dollar is the reserve currency, but also the things that you could criticize about the US, Japan is doing them, Europe's doing them. There's no other developed market currency that isn't that much different than the US. So you're kind of, as far as developed market currencies go, we're all the same. And so that I don't see a real reason the dollar is going to fall out of bed. But that's why I mentioned the Roman situation, that it doesn't mean we don't have inflation, but I don't think it's going to be a quick hyperinflation.
Okay.
So I think we're going to be more in the scenario is not that we go to 15-20% really quickly. But let me also say, I think this is I showed you those charts from the 70s.
Yep.
It's a little bit like a boxing match, right? And you don't knock the guy, the heavyweight guy out in the first. What has happened is, I think things gradually start to fall apart. And so I think we've had a lot of things start to happen over the last 4 years that are setting us up that we weren't going to go right into a high inflationary state right away. What happens is we've had a shot across the bows. We've gone up to 10%. We come back. And that's very common. You get this spike up, you come back, and we'll probably go and have a next rise up. And gradually things unwind. The deficits get higher. The mentality towards spending increases. The idea of tax increases goes away. The economy starts to ossify. And so all these things are happening. I think the obvious thing, and when the academics look through the literature, the thing that can really kickstart this into a faster inflation would be oil prices. I mean, when they look back at the 70s, I think the oil price went from $2 to 12 in like 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine that. Imagine if we had it went
like 2 to 30
by 1980, right?
Could you imagine? So,
I mean, if we had, a move from 90 to 270 or 300, we would have a real hard time dealing with that. And it would be inflationary for many years. That scenario is on the table, right? And this is part of these are part of the setups, right? We have conflict brewing in the Middle East, right? And who knows, so many scenarios there. But just underlying that, we've had a real whole global policy against cheap carbon energy, right? So, and you look at the major oil companies, they are really using their cash to either buy back shares or they're actually investing in renewables as well. They're kind of under pressure to do it. Look at the rig count. It's very subdued. You also look at oil inventories, record lows. The reaction to the Ukraine war was to drain out the, we're sitting here with a potential war in the Middle East with the lowest oil inventories, I think, to like the 1980s. So that is a major setup. And I'm gonna add another thing that people don't really think about. If you think globally, the number of people, so there's a kind of, you can track how many people in the world have a GDP per capita above like $3,000 a year. And that's in kind of emerging markets. It's like the number is growing because of inflation, but call it between $2,000 and $3,000. You get above that level, you start to have a bit of money to spend on maybe an air conditioner, or maybe you're going to buy a scooter. This is what happened and surprised us in 2002 with China. And no one saw the China bull market happen, right? Or what it was going to do to commodities. And that was 2002. China got about 2,500 GDP per capita. Yep. And then it goes on, right? And the whole world reacts, oh my God, 1 billion people are going to start consuming things, and it's going to radically change the demand for commodities across the world. Well, guess what? We're just now adding another 1.3 billion Indians. Our GDP per capita are basically where China was in 2004, 2005. So just kind of, it's a slow moving gradual thing, but just cooking in the background, just to add more fire, put more gas on this. Like, we got no reserves. Oil companies are not drilling for oil because they've been told by, the IEA or the EIA, I can't remember, the one in Geneva, that there's not going to be any need for oil. And oh, by the way, 1 billion Indians just showed up on the market, and they would like to be able to drive cars and drive scooters. And so the setup for energy is very strong. And that is going to be, that's a real potential problem to get this inflation going.
No, I was going to say, you mentioned the 1970s, and I don't want to cut you off, but I think as investors, if we're looking for game plans and frameworks to invest in inflationary regimes, everyone tries to play the last war, as they say. So like the last big inflationary period was the 70s, and so that's the game plan that people go to primarily for how do they navigate this market. Do you think that that's a fair assessment, the 70s and 80s? Do you think this time it's going to be a little bit worse, maybe a little bit different? I know the drivers are a bit different, but in terms of how it plays out and then the actual ways to benefit from the inflation in markets.
Yeah, I think the difference is I find it hard to think that the Fed is going to, I think, we're kind of close to the, I hesitate to say this, but I think we're close to what the Fed can do. The difference is, one big difference with the 70s is we've had 10 years of 0% rates, right?
Yeah.
So we have all borrowed at, companies, people with their mortgages, corporates, at very low rates. And so you have to be very careful about. So the Fed has made this move to 5.5%, which they felt was a very strong move. And it actually was. It's surprising. I mean, it's a shocking move from 0 to 5.5. But I think they've kind of are hitting the ceiling, because now you're already starting to see what's going to happen to the interest payments on the federal debt, right? They're very careful. How is the housing market going to react as people refi? And at least fortunately in the U.S., people have very long mortgages. So my point is, I don't think we're going to get this move up to 15% interest rates in any near term, which could make it, which is beneficial. I think we're going to beneficial for asset prices, and why, you could have, really nice moves in gold, commodities. This is the tricky part that I it's like, where does the money go, right? And this is what we're trying to figure out. And yeah. It could be Bitcoin, it could be semiconductors. And so I say we can talk about inflation and on a very macro level, but how do we play it, and where can we make money?
Right.
It could be different this time around. But I think if I want to talk textbook, what's going to be different about this, I think the Fed it's going to be a lot harder for the Fed to do the Volcker Act. I think right now they're realizing they don't want to cut rates. Do they add another 50 basis points? Possibly. But six and a half, these are going to be really where they're going to, I think they're going to be grinding them out to come up with another. I think we've seen as much as the Fed's going to do for a while.
Yeah. And I mentioned in prior podcasts, but I was listening to a Robert Friedland like panel discussion, and this is on commodities and just like the different demand drivers and things like that. And he mentioned how like the time we're in now is unprecedented in the sense of, like you mentioned, you have 2 billion plus Indians coming into the market with wage increases. You have the electrification of grids within China, within the US, to ramp up these EVs. Whether the ROI is there or not, it doesn't really matter. The government's saying, hey, like, this is where we're going. And you're seeing that in China, you're seeing that in India. So you've got this electrification demand, you've got this Indian wealth demand, and you throw in this military conflict in the Middle East and in the Ukraine and in Russia, and you have all these demand drivers for these metals at a time when supply has been underinvested for 20 plus years. And so that's like to me, that is like one of the most attractive setups is like, yes, we're long gold and we're long silver, but like I've been so big on copper because that's kind of how I see the world and see all these drivers impact. Like, has there been another time where you've had so many large drivers for a dwindling supply of metals?
I think you're hitting this on the head. The India story, right? Like you said, I want to just say one other thing that it's really interesting to listen to the conference calls of Eaton Corporation, and the stock has gone through the roof. But I find their what they're saying has so much macro significance, and they do electrical equipment for data centers. They're in the aerospace industry.
Their stock has absolutely
worked. Right. Yes. And they also provide electrical equipment to the utilities.
Okay.
They're like five or different industries, right? And the CEO has said, we have never seen this before. I mean, Greg, I mean, this is not like the longest history of, right? But he's like, we cannot believe almost everything we're doing is on fire. Aerospace. Yeah. There's just a pent up demand for commercial aircraft. The defense spending as well. So aerospace is going through the roof. Data centers, he said, look, we're stacked. We have more demand than we can deal with data centers. And we haven't even started AI data centers, which apparently are configured differently and use more power and everything else.
Yeah.
He said utilities are dramatically revising up electricity demand. They, you know, used to be the electricity demand grew at 1-2%. They're now like, some of them are looking at like potentially 5-6% electric growth, and they're having to invest in the grid, power demand. So they're spending. The CHIP Act, right? So we have now semiconductor companies onshoring. I think Taiwan Semi is trying to plant a $40 billion chip plant in Phoenix. Intel's building fabs. You have the onshoring of just a lot of industries feeling that they want to bring stuff back to the U.S. You have the green thing, you know, we need to build solar farms, wind farms, battery storage things. The guy said, look, it is off the charts, all the stuff happening right now. And that's and it's like, I almost say like the US is the new China, right? Like guys are saying like, look, I can't believe what's happening in the US. And then you have a little bit of stimulus happening in China as well. You're right. It seems like a lot of stuff is cooking here.
Yeah.
And like you said, I mean, also on the supply side, right? First Quantum, like you go into the projects, Cobre Panama gets confiscated by the government. Tech's project, taking forever. There's Anglo American canceled some Los Bronces expansion they were going to do. Supply is very challenged, and it's very difficult to bring on new copper projects. They cost a lot. There are very few jurisdictions where companies want to operate. The environmental restrictions are through the roof, even in emerging markets around dust in the Andes, water supply.
This is all with oil, like relatively, like it's not, oil's not 100, 150. Like if oil goes to 100, 150, then ASICs blow up. And then you need $16,000 you know, a ton copper, $16,000, $17,000 a ton copper just to maintain your margin profile, because I mean, your diesel cost is a huge part of your ASICs. And then we haven't even discussed the labor shortage that's happening in the mine supply.
Yes. And I wanted to say that was the other big thing Eaton said. They said, look, they said the bottleneck to everything is there are not enough people. Yeah. And this is the interesting thing they said about the Inflation Reduction Act. He said this, the way the credit works is you actually have to create a project and then you get a tax break on the project and the profits, but you have to spend the money. So he said there's a real kind of push to get these projects going, but they said they just don't have the welders, tradesmen. Yep. And they said, look, on our side, we're just paying up. We're on our house. We're trying to keep our house in order and we're paying up for labor. But what they worry about is like on any project, it's controlled by the weakest link in the chain. Like you might have got, you know, you're doing your piece of the project, but some other guy's providing the ventilation and he doesn't have workers for his thing. So he says their view was that the demand is going to be at a high level for an extended period for many years because it's just going to take that long for all this stuff to get done. So yeah, he said, look, wages just are going to be very well supported.
Yeah. And all of this eventually gets passed through to the consumer at one point in time. And then that's how you have higher prices. And I remember, I forget what podcast it was, but basically the theme was like China has been this huge deflationary release valve for the world where cheap labor, cheap commodities, we've outsourced all the commodity production and material and processing to China. And then, as you mentioned, like this onshoring, this deglobalization, all of those levers that led to that deflation are changing and they're now inflationary. And I saw something in, I think it was one part of like the battery EV subsidies, where at a certain point in time, I don't know if it's 2025 or 2030, a certain percentage of the critical raw materials that go into these batteries, into these EVs, have to be from US or I guess like safe air quotes jurisdictions, right? So not China, not, you know, Russia, they consider those bad. The problem with that is we don't have the infrastructure for any of that, which is also inflationary, because if you say, hey, we're going to give you a subsidy for this, you have to then create the infrastructure and create all these mines, create the rare earth element mines to actually have the material from a safe jurisdiction to benefit from the subsidy. And we don't have any of that. I mean, China manufactures and processes like 100% of our graphite. And graphite is used in so many things, like aerospace, for instance. So many things that we use graphite for. We don't have any U.S. production in it. And like all that costs money and labor and time and things to get going.
So, Brandon, I want to go back. So I think this is going to go back to our general macro. The point I wanted to make at the end, remember at the end of the Rogoff thing, was that it's policy driven, right?
Yeah.
And I think this, all these policies, these onshoring, the environmental regulations, they are very inflationary. Regulating, you know, basically trying to reduce free trade really helps an incumbent US company, right? And what, from an economist standpoint, what you're doing with a lot of these free trade or the carbon kind of gate in Europe, you're restricting international competition. Mm-hmm. Which benefits the domestic firm, which gives them pricing power, which makes it more monopolistic, which basically raises prices. It reduces supply and increase. So you are in many ways making the corporates more monopolistic and giving them more pricing power and making it harder for supply to come in with these regulations. And so that's on the kind of, I think this actually inflation is going to be persistent is exactly that. It's hard to quantify this, right? But I see the government that are actually, I would consider, are not very free market. They're actually being very hands-on, and I think often the unintended side consequences of these things are all inflationary. Lots of, you know, side effects, things they didn't expect. Oh, you know, we can't have lithium from this country, that country. Oh, okay, great. Well, then how are we going to make it in the US? Because now you've just passed this other law that says you can't use water or what, you know. So Yeah, it makes it, it's gonna, I think we're gonna have, yeah, it makes everything really expensive to get anything done.
And one of the big points that we mentioned before we recorded was to take all of this information about the macro and distill it down into micro decisions and micro game plans. And so we touched a little bit on it earlier. How do we invest in this? And you mentioned, you know, a few companies like Eaton, and then another one that I just, you know, kind of threw up off the top of my head. Like if you look at Encore Wire, like WIRE, they do a lot of the copper wiring for buildings and interiors and stuff like that. I mean, that's another chart that just went straight up into the right.
Yeah.
It's like just straight inflationary play. And so when you look at your investable universe, and again, I've no idea what your portfolio construction is, how you think about that, and we can dive into that. How do you take this macro view and then implement it into a portfolio construction?
Okay. I feel like I'm old. I have, over time, I've become a lot more interested in whatever I'm doing, that I'm getting dividends and share buybacks. And I think this is from sitting and staring at companies that you think are going to be great and they do nothing. And so I've looked at stocks that I didn't even think that were, I had, maybe I had ConocoPhillips in my portfolio for years and wasn't even paying attention to it. One day I was looking at it, I was like, wow, this has like been one of the best performing things I have owned. Of all the other nonsense I've been doing, this thing has been paying dividends, buying back shares, and my Charles Schwab account was automatically reinvesting the dividends. And I'm like, oh wow, that actually was the best thing. So I've been doing, and I have this portfolio I write about called the Dirty Dividends Portfolio. It's a combination of things. I think we have an amazing opportunity in what are the value sectors. And I call them the untouchables. Mm-hmm. I am long big energy. I am long Glencore. I am long European banks. European banks, by the way, I think are generally going to benefit from higher rates. They're going to have much higher interest. They're selling money, if you think about it, basically. And the price of money is going to be higher. And I think people are getting the banks wrong. But anyways, so I'm in some of the big stable mining and energy companies. I own a little bit of tobacco. Europe is basically very cheap. Europe, UK is very cheap. I just started buying Chinese tech stocks. I own Tencent. I bought Baidu. I have this new theme called the Dragon 7, which is the offset to the Mag 7.
Yeah.
One thought, okay? I don't know, but I'm just going to throw this on the table as a potential. I'm always like thinking, how does the market actually kind of screw with our heads and do counterintuitive things to us? Post GFC, the economy was relatively weak. Main Street was relatively weak, but Wall Street boomed, right? We were kind of always saying, oh, wow, the economy's, you know, not that great, but, you know, the S&P was, the multiple was expanding. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a surprise. I think people were surprised how well the market did relative to the actual economy. And people were complaining about that. I wonder if to some extent that reverse might happen this time, where we have a very strong economy, or quite stronger than expected economy with all this real hard industry happening, like data centers, you know, construction, and that actually maybe tech doesn't do as well over time. I mean, it may still go up, right? There's a lot going on, but I'm like, I think possibly international stocks and value may outperform here for a few years, because I think one of the pushbacks of, if inflation stays high and the Fed stays at, you know, 5 or 6, we could get a little mini 2022 again, right? Which is, I think, may play out this year, which people are going, oh wow, we came into this year expecting, you know, rates to go down to, I don't know what, 2.5% or whatever, you know, we're gonna have 3 or 4 rate cuts or something this year.
Yeah.
And that's now not looking like it's going to happen. And so, you know, and possibly the Fed has to consider whether it actually needs to raise rates. So how does the expensive tech sector react to that? Basically, what's happening is the real economy is stronger than you expect, and you're not getting the fiscal stimulus, the monetary stimulus you want. Does tech you know, chop around and do nothing. And actually the real action is in the, you know, other spaces, the value sectors are the more the industrial sector.
Yeah.
So that's something to consider.
It's funny you mentioned the European banks, because I mean, I don't know if you're a chartist or not, but I get bullied a little bit for putting charts on Twitter, being a value guy. But if you look at these, if you look at the charts of some of these European banks that have just been bombed out, like if you look at Lloyds Banking Group, if you look at UniCredit, there was another one. What was it? Barclays, maybe. Like you look at these banks and they're forming these large bases. Like UniCredit is just like, UniCredit has gone nowhere since 2011. It trades at the same price as it did in September 2011. And it's completely hated. And I really like that idea. Like I really like the idea of long the European financials, just because they're so hated and everyone thinks that it's just a dead money trade. And you're one of the few people that have said that on the podcast.
Brandon, are you playing with me?
No, I'm literally looking at the UniCredit chart right now.
I am the biggest bull on all of these things. I have half my portfolio in these things. I own all of them. I own Barclays. I own UniCredit. I own Santander. I own Commerce Bank in Germany. I think this is a tremendous multi-year trade in these stocks.
Yeah.
I mean, I basically to sum it up, for 10 years, these companies had multiple problems. Higher and higher capital requirements. They were making they were trying to delever to fit, you know, we were all fighting the last war, right? Basel I, but after the GFC, banks were required to have more and more capital. Required tier one ratio for a bank went from 4% to like 12.
Yeah.
So post GFC, and actually this is interesting because it comes back to our inflation story. What people don't realize is from 2009 to like 2020, the aggregate balance sheet of the European banking sector was a flat line. The US grew their banking assets at like a 3% CAGR. So kind of low, but a little bit. Europe was flat. And what was happening was the banks were reacting to more and more regulation and the capital requirements. So they were retaining, or they were not growing the loan book. And every year they'd make money and they would just retain it and pay out a small dividend. And meanwhile, so their capital ratios, they were slowly deleveraging, right? As fast as they could, basically, without having to do emergency rights issues.
Yeah.
So what happens was we were sitting there with all this monetary stimulus, the ECBs at negative rates going, why is the economy not growing? Multiple reasons. Why is there no inflation? Well, you know what? Your entire banking sector, you're sitting on the, you think you're pushing on the gas. But meanwhile, the entire banking sector, the Basel regulators are slamming the banking sector is on the brakes. They're not lending. They're on the defensive about everything that happened to GFC. They don't want to lend. They don't want to have any risk or anything happen because, oh my God, they're going to get nationalized or something.
Yeah.
So they were terrified. And so that has been happening for 10 years. But now in 2019, 2020, cap tier one ratios at European banks were like between 14 and 16%. Way highest they've ever been in my career. I mean, they've never been this high.
Yeah.
And way above the story, effectively that issue was put to bed. Done. You now have way more capital than you need. Issue number two was negative interest rates, right? When you're a bank, it's very hard to make a spread when you're at zero. If you look at banks in like Latin America where interest rates are high, they'll have net interest margins of 4 or 5%. In Africa, they can have like 8% net interest margins. It's really easy to make a spread when you can lend at 20 and borrow at 10 or something, right? When it's zero, they couldn't make a spread or very, very minor spread. Now you've had interest rates of, you know, ECBs, I think at 4%, you know, their spreads have massively widened for European banks. And they haven't been lending. So everyone was worried about like, oh my God, interest rates have gone up. The banks are going to have a credit crisis. Credit crises generally happen when you've been lending at 20, you've been growing a loan book at 20% and something, all of a sudden, there's a financial crisis or there's an interest rate that they hadn't been lending. So there was no, to me, there was no built up, you know, loan book risks. When you're sitting, basically, if you're a big bank in a corp company in a country, you just lend to your big corp. You lend to the phone company, you lend to the, you know, the utility. Those loans aren't going bad, and you just, so it's when you, it's the new loan. So I knew, so what we have now is expanding margins. Banks have too much, they're making now these record profits they've never made before, and they don't know what to do with the money. So for the moment, they're doing massive share buybacks. I think UniCredit's buying back $5 billion worth of shares this year. So you're getting dividends, you're getting share buybacks. And I think what's going to happen next with these banks is they're going to start to lend. And this comes back to the inflation. What happens when the banking sector decides, wait a second, we don't think there's going to be, they were always told there was going to be a recession in 2023 and 2024. So they've been kind of kept their head down and not, but I like, if that mentality flips to, oh, wait a second, we're making lots of money, we've done buybacks, we've done dividends, we're still making money, why don't we grow?
Yeah.
So I think that could also be another kicker on the inflation fire that we're building. But anyways, these stocks, like Barclays, for example, I think the stock's at 180 or something today. I think they're going to make like 40p in 2025. 40p, okay? Where do you put, what multiple do you put on that? You put, you know, if you were to put a 9x multiple on it, you know, you're over £3. I mean, it's a double.
Yeah.
To get to 9x earnings. I mean, it's like, so I think there's a lot of the
low hurdle.
Banks are just, to me, like, I use very conservative forecasts, and I think there's a lot of upside, and you're going to get paid dividends along the way and buy back shares. And so, yeah, interesting you brought that up, but it's my biggest allocation, and it's my biggest thing, and I write about it, and I love it.
I mean, you get like crickets on Twitter. Like if you mention European banks, like big European banks, like no one owns them, or no one wants to talk about them.
Yeah. They look great.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Awesome. Well, Eric, this has been such a great conversation. If there's anything we missed about the inflation narrative, I know we discussed kind of the US analogy with the Roman Empire, and maybe we can kind of end there with, if this plays out and things get worse, like what, like if we use that as an analogy, what would that look like in the US? If we, let's say the next 2 to 4 years, inflation gets worse, things start deteriorating, how would that look versus a Roman Empire analogy?
Yeah, the Roman Empire analogy is more for me just to say to people, like when they say, well, we're the reserve currency, we can't have inflation. I go, you know, yes, you can. You can still happen. And it happened, you know, it doesn't mean the U.S. isn't still in its geopolitical prominent position. We can still have it. And it's also, but it's, you know, it's the empire analogy is increasing corruption, increased military spending. The Roman Empire, it got increasingly corrupt. They put more and more of their budget towards supporting the military. Things started to fall apart at the outer edges of in Carthage, and it kind of just was just deteriorating. And I get back to the politics, and when you study, Cuppy is interesting because he really, you know, he always thinks, he thinks it's very interesting to study how culture changes with inflation. And it's very, when you read the stories about France and the Assassinats or Weimar Germany, it's when there's a shift away from savings, right? Because money's losing its value quickly. So you don't save. There's a shift towards speculation, an obsession with luxury, corruption, especially at the political level. All these things start to happen. And when you look at, you know, I think it's just an interesting lens when you kind of look at what's going on, and you can kind of go behind the scenes to go a little bit, these are the telltale signs of a inflation creeping into the economy. A lot of the value systems break down as it happens. And so that's, you know, and I'll just say another thing. I had drinks with a friend from Zimbabwe the other night, and he didn't know what we were talking about. We were talking about South Africa, actually. And he goes, oh, in South Africa, the main political party is under pressure that they may not have a majority anymore, the ANC. And he says, they're talking about land reform again now. They're talking about maybe confiscating land from the white owners or, you know, white businesses. And that's always been something that was a fringe idea, but it's kind of becoming maybe the main parties. And the Zimbabwean was like, look, well, because that's what they did in Zimbabwe. And that just lit the hyper. That whole thing fell apart when that happened. He goes, look, I think that's the rand is probably, if they, this is probably the rand is about to really start to lose value. And he goes, it always happens. He goes, it's always politics first. And I was like, wow, you know, we just spent an hour and a half and reading economic papers to come around to, we think it's actually policy driven is what really drives and this guy in Zimbabwe is like, oh yeah, no, that's, it always starts with the politics. The politics drives the inflation. And I thought, wow, it's like to the man on the street in Zimbabwe, that's like, as you know, that's as clear as day.
Yep. So yeah, it's just, like, there's almost no need to overcomplicate it. Right.
Yeah. Just, I thought it was just,
you can make it that simple.
It was so obvious to him, you know?
Awesome. Well, Eric, this conversation has been fantastic. For people that want to learn more about you, read more of your stuff, get in contact, where can they do that?
Oh, thanks. I have a blog or a Substack, and it's but you can go to www.ywr.world, and the YWR stands for your weekend reading. So I try and write twice a week, something on Tuesday or Wednesday and something on Friday or Saturday, and I try to make it actionable, try to think the most useful thing, and also as much as possible tie it back to a way to make money, you know, an idea, an investment idea as well. But that's where I post my stuff. Thanks.
And then the last question that I ask every guest, if you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Ooh.
Yeah, I didn't prep you with this one before. So this is right off the cuff for you.
Sheesh, I think I want to say Buffett would be good. And I know that sounds very normal, or that sounds very I think that's consensus.
Sounds like a cop out.
Yeah, it's a cop out, but I find with him, I can't believe how many things he says that are just so common sense and right, and over time, and I go back to it and I go, I can't believe he's writing this stuff about private equity and just it's off the top of my mind. I have come to appreciate him more and more. The business structure, how he built Berkshire Hathaway, the use of the insurance business. I don't know if he would actually talk that. I don't know how much of a dinner, how articulate he would be about these things, but I'm finding myself over time being more and more interested in reading his letters over and over again. So anyways, that's a cop out, but I would say that one for now.
Awesome. Well, Eric, thanks again so much for doing this. I'm excited to share it. And I learned a lot about inflation and the different drivers and how it impacts equities. And thank you for giving me a crash course on the history of it, not just what's happening today, but what's happened in the 70s, the 80s, and even going back further. So I think my listeners are going to love it. And let's do this again soon, hopefully when it's not hyperinflation, but maybe something a little bit different, maybe a whole European banking podcast.
That'd be fun. Thanks, Brandon.
This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally, with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive. Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, M-A-R, HELM.com to get your discount today.